You're listening to the New Evangelicals Podcast. Welcome to the New Evangelicals Talks. I'm Tim, the host of this segment. Join us every Monday as we talk to all different kinds of people at the intersection of theology, politics, and culture, helping you navigate a better path forward in your faith. Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of TNE Talks. On this episode, I interviewed Christina Dent. She is the founder of End It For Good, helping us think more compassionately and humanely about drug use. What do we do with people who are struggling with addiction or with dependence on drugs? What is the Christian and humane approach? This might really challenge you. And also, it might blow some of your political boxes because just like my previous guest last week talking about immigration, Christina would also say she's more of a conservative usually. Yet on this issue, man, some of her takes and the work that she's doing just seems so important. So I love having guests on who kind of help us think differently and expand our worldview. Hopefully you enjoyed this episode. Speaking of guests, I would love to know, who do you want to see on the podcast? What people do you want me to talk to? I've been thinking a lot about this. I love doing book interviews. I love talking to authors, but I really want us to have conversations with people all over the spectrum at the intersection of theology, politics, and culture, helping us think more widely and holistically about some of these major issues that we find ourselves facing in 2024 America. So if you have some people you want me to talk to, whether it's maybe a politician or a scientist or an ethicist or whatever, shoot me an email, info@thenewevangelicals.com. I'd love to hear from you. As always, friends, thank you so much for being here. Thanks for supporting the work that we do. We are a nonprofit organization holding space for people as they navigate a better path forward. We do all of this work completely paywall free because of the generosity of people like you. If you want to donate, you can click on the link in our show notes and you can support the work. As a nonprofit, all donations made are tax deductible. Hey, check out this interview with Christina. Hope you enjoy it. Talk to you all later on. See ya. All right. Well, Christina Dent, thank you so much for making time. You started an organization called End It For Good. You wrote a book called Curious, Foster's Mom Discovery of an Unexpected Solution to Drugs and Addiction. So thanks for making time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tim. Excited to be with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's just kind of start from the beginning. This is obviously in the U.S., it's a major issue, the issue of drug use and overdoses, all that kind of stuff. What got you into starting an organization that really focused on trying to end it for good?
Yeah, so my journey didn't start until a couple of years ago. Most of my life, I supported a tough criminal justice approach to drugs and addiction. I didn't use drugs when I was growing up in high school or college. I have a degree in Bible. It just wasn't part of my world or life. And so I didn't think about it deeply, really. I mean, it wasn't that I sort of supported what the culture around me supported. I'm in Mississippi, born and raised in Mississippi, grew up in a conservative Christian culture, very much so, and still identify with a lot of that. I've changed my mind on some things, certainly on this issue, but so I came to this as somebody who wasn't looking for it, as not somebody who was just sort of desperate to find a solution, but as a foster mom who began to realize, wait, there is a lot more to this than meets the eye through meeting the mother of one of our foster sons.
Mm. It's interesting. You're actually, it just worked out this way, but you're the second person I've had on who grew up in a conservative environment and then had this moment that changed her perspective. I was talking to another guest who does a lot of work on immigration reform. She would still identify in a lot of ways as a conservative Christian woman, but her experience being at the border and being in Mexico really shifted how she understood the topic of immigration and undocumented immigrants, et cetera. And it sounds like you kind of also had an experience in your own life that, again, shifted how you understood a topic into a different way of being. And I honestly resonate with that because I grew up very conservative Christian in many ways. And over time, my experience of the world got bigger and my mind had to change its perspective on some things from how I was taught the world operates to the reality of how the world operates. So for you, what is the story there going from someone who grew up, you know, in Mississippi in this very conservative bubble, which I resonate with. And I'm sure like you, I was taught, hey, if you do the crime, do the time, you know, if you're caught with drugs, like you just go to prison and pay your dues. What changed your perspective on this? What were some of the moments?
So we began fostering in 2014, my husband and I, and we had two young sons at the time. And we had fostered one child, but really didn't have any connection with their birth family at all. So there wasn't really an opportunity for any relationship there. But the second child that we fostered came to us, and this is really the story that I tell in the beginning of Curious, came to us in December, a couple of years later, straight from the hospital after he was born. He was born exposed to substances, and so he had been removed from his mom's custody when he was born. That's common practice all throughout Mississippi and many other places. Yep. And so, you know, when I thought about, here's a mom who was using drugs while she was pregnant, I saw that through the lens of what I had grown up around. Now, no one ever expressly told me that's a terrible person, but that's just sort of what I picked up from the broader U.S. culture, the way we think about drug use, people who use drugs, people who struggle with addiction, mothers who struggle with addiction, mothers who would use while they're pregnant. Like there's this sort of hierarchy of stigma. Yes. And she would be on the top end of that as somebody who was using while she was pregnant.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any other way of thinking about it. And so when I brought her son to his first visitation with her, just a couple of days after he came to us straight from the hospital after his birth, that was kind of in my mind, was just, this is not somebody like me. She's doing things I would never do. I'm a mom. I would never use drugs while I'm pregnant, is what I'm thinking. And so I pull into the child welfare office and I pop his car seat out of my van. I turn around to go walk in the building. And here comes this woman sprinting across the parking lot, tears streaming down her face. And she runs over and she starts kissing this baby that I'm holding. And this is his mom, Joanne. Mm. I'm totally taken aback. I don't have any category for that. My first response really was suspicion over, this can't really be true. I mean, I'm not even sure I would run over. I mean, it just was very raw, this kind of raw expression of affection for this child. So I felt really suspicious about it. I left him with her for his 1 hour of visitation. I came back to pick him up and I came into the little tiny visitation room and she was sitting in the corner of the couch. The room was so small, the couch literally took up an entire wall of it. And she was sitting there with him sleeping on her shoulder. It's just this image I'll never forget of her with her eyes closed, but she's not sleeping. Like she's just drinking in this moment with her son of this 1 hour that she gets with him. Mm. And then she has to leave for inpatient drug treatment several hours away. She's working hard to get him to be able to join her there. It's actually a treatment center that allows parents and children to be together. They have childcare on site. They support parental bonding. It's really amazing. Now at the time I thought that sounded crazy. I thought, what on earth? Like, why would we put children anywhere near parents who are struggling with addiction? But it was just another one of those things that was this evolution for me of thought and understanding, because Beckham comes back to our house. Joanne goes to treatment. But she calls me every day and she'll ask me all the things about how he's doing and give her any detail that I can possibly give her about the life of a newborn, which is very boring. And then she'll ask me to put her on speakerphone and she would sing to him over the phone. And it was just this soul touching. I mean, it really was like, Tim, it was just sacred ground. Like this is, I'm a stranger to her, but she's letting me in on this very vulnerable display of love and affection for her child. And the more that I got to know her, the more I could not shut out that this is real. This is true. She loves him this much. And that challenged everything I thought I knew about addiction, people who use drugs. And it set me on this learning journey because I knew that the majority of children in foster care are there for drug-related reasons with their parents. And so if there was anything that we were doing with drugs that could be changed to get better outcomes, it could just have this seismic impact across foster care. And then as I began to learn, I realized, wow, it actually impacts all these other areas of life. And that set me on this journey of learning and eventually to changing my mind and eventually to founding an organization to invite other people to change their minds too.
What was the hardest thing to change your mind on when it came to this journey of, you know, just your world being rocked by experience, right? Because I totally understand. I'm someone who grew up on talk radio my whole life. I very much understand the mentality of the almost dehumanization of how we treat people who struggle with substance abuse, et cetera, right? We just kind of put them in this very lowly place. I mean, I track a lot of far right commentators, and recently Ben Shapiro came through Kensington, Philadelphia to do his bit on how bad Democratic policies are and how, you know, Kensington, Philadelphia is a horrible place. And to be truthful, it is, you know, known as in some places, the mecca of the heroin capital of the world. Truly. I mean, this is a real thing because drugs are rampant. So it's a fair point, but they use it as a way to dehumanize other people. So for you, what were some of the real challenges to get over as you were rewiring your brain to see this issue through a different perspective?
So I think one of them was that I think there were two main ones, and then they splintered into all kinds of other challenges. Cause I talk about this now and I can, you know, do an interview in an hour or 30 minutes or whatever and talk about this change of mind. This was about a year and a half process and did not feel fun or exciting or, it was really challenging. So I think there was a heart change that was going on there of realizing that the way that I perceived myself, which was as a very empathetic person, had limits. I was very empathetic in certain areas with certain groups of people, but not with everyone. And I had never noticed that before. I had just thought of it as, you know, I give compassion where compassion is due. And it just never really occurred to me that that didn't extend to all people or to people who were struggling in this particular area. And so part of it was just this heart coming to face my own judgment, my own lack of compassion. And a big part of that was relearning what really is driving addiction. So I had grown up more with this idea of people who use drugs are bad people. Mm-hmm. People who struggle with addiction are sort of a next level of bad person.
Right.
And so the more that I learned about addiction, the more I learned that really, if you look at what the major drivers of addiction are, it's people who have been through really painful things in their life, often things outside of their control. They have been through traumatic events as children. They've been through abuse or neglect. They're struggling with mental health challenges. It might be, you know, loneliness, guilt. I mean, there's just so many different things, but it's a coping mechanism for pain in our lives, whether that's mental, physical, emotional. I mean, it could be lots of different things, but this suffering that's underneath addiction was not something that I knew anything about. And that broke my heart. Just realizing it's almost like on this sliding scale, like the people that we demonize the most because their addictions have taken the most from them, their lives are the most visibly broken, are often the people that if we could see deeply into their lives, we would weep. Just weep over the suffering that they have been through. Maybe some of it has been from their own decisions, but oftentimes the beginning of that snowball of suffering was things outside of their control that they were through. So there was this heart change. And then there was also just this like mind change of actually having to learn, like learning, reading, re-educating myself on what are we doing with drugs and why are we doing that? And what is the outcome of that? So there was kind of this intellectual shift that was happening that required time and effort to learn, and this heart change that was happening. Both of those very difficult. It is incredibly difficult to rethink anything in our lives. I mean, just nobody likes to grapple with, is something that I have believed maybe not true, or maybe has my intent been correct, but the outcome of where I have sort of landed on that is really not what I'm looking for. And I need to find some different tools to use to get to the outcomes we actually want, which on this issue, I think no matter where people fall, they want healthy people, living people, intact families, safe communities. I think all of us want those things. And I think we have misunderstood how to get them.
Yeah. Where was your faith during this process, right? Again, like it sounds like you and I grew up in similar cultural paradigms. Now, I am in the Northeast, but there's still a very heavy conservative Christian presence here. I kind of grew up in the middle of that as someone who was homeschooled and all that stuff. And it is interesting, right? How on one hand, we're claiming to follow a Jesus that loved the ones who society called unlovable, right? And yet our faith oftentimes can be incredibly judgmental of people who are struggling with substance addiction and who are, you know, falling on hard times. And so for you as someone who might even still use the conservative Christian moniker for certain things that you would still hold dear, you know, where was your faith in this process? Did you have a moment of realizing like, oh crap, sometimes my faith is actually driving my judgmentalism instead of being curious and being empathetic, and I have to rethink that? What was that like for you?
So I have this kind of vivid memory of beginning to realize that my mind was shifting, and not just on, wow, I have radically misunderstood addiction, but the more that I read, the more I became convinced we have also incorrectly handled how we handle drug markets, that allowing drugs to be sold in legally regulated markets where they're not contaminated, where we have age restrictions, where there is potency and purity guidelines, is on the whole is a much less harmful way to handle substances than pushing them into these underground markets where it's funding criminal activity, it's contaminated, people are dying from fentanyl. That was really challenging. It was one thing to kind of be, to have my heart change around, wow, I have lacked compassion for people. But really that, as I continued to learn, grew into this mind change over the actual policies of how we're handling it, how we're handling drug possession for people who use drugs, but also how we're handling these markets and this push to continually like criminalize everything that's causing a problem, which actually just creates an explosion of additional harm. And so that all was part of this feeling of, I remember having this thought, can I even be a Christian anymore and change my mind about this? Like it felt yeah. so deeply tied. It wasn't that I felt like I was losing my faith. It was that I became uncertain suddenly about, wait, is this policy tied to my faith? Like, or is there room to change my mind on this policy? I think I feel like it's more consistent with my faith, and I had never wrestled through that before of kind of separating out which things are core pieces of my faith and which things are maybe culturally have been wound together with that.
Yeah.
And needed to be unwound from that. So I'm a much bigger supporter of kind of that separation of church and state than I used to be, in large part just because as I've learned about this issue, I've realized how much damage has been done by wielding scripture to say this, you know, we've got to hold people accountable and we have to, you know, hold this kind of moral line. And I would say, I actually think we're losing moral ground by criminalizing and punishing and giving criminal records to people who are suffering and who need help finding healing. And so it's a difference of perspective. It's not a difference. I often tell people my values didn't change, but I learned new information and it changed my mind about the solutions that are best in line with the values that I hold.
Welcome to Why We Deconstruct. No, but I mean, for real, I think you summed it up really well. I don't feel like my values have changed at all. I feel like they were more and more realized in my life. And then certain perspectives I had shifted based on those values being consistent, right? Humanization, empathy, love of neighbor. And so when I saw friends of mine in different spaces who were being marginalized by my own faith, I went, wait, my value doesn't add up with the values I've been taught and the ones that I believe. And, you know, I think sometimes people think that folks like myself and maybe others that we enjoy, you know, critiquing, you know, evangelicalism or the church. And it's not, I don't enjoy having to admit that most of my upbringing I've had to renegotiate because of how much harm it's been causing over so many issues. I mean, this is just one out of several that I've unfortunately had to reckon with the history of and say, I think maybe white evangelicals, broadly speaking, were not on the right side. And I think about this issue a lot because, you know, I didn't realize that certain administrations in our country's history that were supported by white evangelicals called crack cocaine crack in certain communities and called cocaine, you know, something else in different communities, and how there were all kinds of racial, you know, overlaps to that, and how we talk about what a thug is compared to someone who struggles with substance abuse, and how, you know, we have evidence now that our own government flooded inner cities with crack cocaine, right? And handed out harsher sentences for those people compared to people in the suburbs. Like, there's a lot of layers that are very uncomfortable to face and to reckon with. But to your point, our values lead me to have to face those realities and say, man, if we were on the wrong side of this, I have to repent and do what I can to try and make those wrongs right. And I feel like when it comes to the so-called war on drugs, and we look at our mass incarceration problem in the US, where, you know, we have 5% of the world's population, but 20% of the world's prison population, something just seems very wrong with that, especially when most of those offenses are, to your point, drug offenses. And it just seems like it's this real tough posture on the war on drugs, and, you know, we have to bring the hammer down on people, doesn't seem to really be working a whole lot.
Hi, all. My name is Rhiannon, and I live in Central Oregon. I have been a TNE donor for the past year or so. I stumbled across the New Evangelicals on Instagram a little over a year ago. TNE has helped me through one of my darkest chapters in the church and has allowed me to have grace with myself as I wrestle with and challenge the way church is being done in mainstream evangelicalism. As I slowly make my way out of the basement, TNE is bringing so much light and hope that we can all be better and do better. I support TNE because I find tremendous value in what Tim and team are doing. It is so important to recognize that we do not have to live under the current norms, but instead we can challenge those norms and be the change. I am grateful every day for the New Evangelicals and encourage anyone who can to support this important work.
One of the stories that I tell in my book, Curious, that has resonated, it resonated with me when I first heard it. It has resonated with lots of people because it gives us a little bit of like some visuals to understand what's actually going on and why we've gotten this so wrong. Is an experiment that was done years ago called Rat Park. There was a researcher who was working in an addiction treatment clinic because he had to. It was like part of, he was getting his PhD and he had to go, you know, do the rounds. Didn't want to, thought, oh dear, you know, these are bad people. I don't want to be around them. And yet when he went and started working with them, he's a psychologist. And as he worked with them, he said, wow, this is not at all what I thought. They're telling me about their lives. They're telling me about the reasons why they use drugs. And so he was also teaching. He was a professor. So he went and told his students what he was learning in this clinic. And the students said, no, these people are lying to you. I know they're lying because there are these rat experiments where you put a rat in a box. It's a research box, a little bitty box. You give it access to heroin or cocaine laced water, and it can choose to have some of that anytime it wants to. And look at what the rats do in these experiments. They just push the lever and push the lever, and they keep drinking the water until they end up overdosing and dying. See, that's what it does to you. This is what, you know, drugs, they hook you. That's all that they're going to do, is lead you to death. Well, so Dr. Alexander, who was hearing about this, he says, well, that doesn't make sense with what we know about rats. Rats are highly social creatures. They like to be with lots of other rats. They like to have things to do. So he rebuilt the experiment on the floor of his lab. And they called it Rat Park. And they created this big open space with lots of rats in it, things for them to do, tin cans for them to play in, this wonderful rat life.
Yes.
And they gave them the drug-laced water. They could use it anytime they wanted to. And what they found is the rats almost never chose to use the drug-laced water. And if they used it, they didn't use it excessively. It was almost like recreational use very infrequently. And so what came out of that experiment was this rethinking of the role of the drug in someone's addiction versus what drives them to use the drug. So like the drug is just the coping mechanism, but it's not the thing that causes the addiction. The the risk factors for the addiction are already there in a person's life. And so their environment and their experiences have a lot more to do with whether or not they're going to reach for that substance and whether that substance is going to become a problem. But what he found is the same thing that most of us find when we start talking about things are discovering, which is nobody wanted to hear it. It went against the prevailing ideas of the day. Academics didn't want to hear it. Their careers were based on this idea that the drug is the problem. And he was trying to say, no, that the if you only look at a very small thing, like putting a rat in an empty box, and he only has the drug, it's going to look like that. But when you take into it the whole context of what we know, you can see that there's a lot more going on there. And so that for me was a big learning point of, and now, you know, it really has shifted the way I think about all kinds of behavior that people engage in is looking underneath. Like our behaviors are a response. We develop those behaviors through millions of experiences during our lifetime. So if someone is doing something, why are they doing that? It's not because they just woke up this morning and just said, I think I'm going to do that. Like there's a whole reason why they do the things they do. There's things in my own life I'm still trying to figure out. Why do I do that thing?
Same.
I wish I would have stopped that thing like 15 years ago. I just can't kick this. Why?
Why do I keep going through the Taco Bell drive-thru at 1 a.m.? Like, what is it about Taco Bell?
It never does.
I always regret it.
And I keep going back. Yes. There's just so many things.
Hypothetically, of course.
Yes. And so even when we talk about addiction, I think it's always important not to try to put too tight of a bow on top of that. I think we're so in American culture, we are so desperate to just put a bow on things. Like we want it to be clear, concise. We want to be able to explain something very succinctly. And these are complicated experiences, complicated challenges. Everybody's path into addiction is different. Everybody's path out of addiction is different. We need to be careful not to paint it with too broad of a brush, but I think we can say what we know about addiction and what drives addiction is not reflected in how we respond to addiction right now. That's largely true in policy. It's largely true in the church that we still have this very stigmatized view, and it leads people not to share. Families don't want to share that they have a loved one struggling.
Right.
People don't want to share that they have struggled, because what will people think of us if we admit that? Will they look at us differently? Will they not allow us to serve in a particular way? Will they not think that we can teach? Will they, you know, what are all of the repercussions of that? These are very real questions people have to ask. We have an opportunity to change the way that we approach those things. I mean, we've changed things all through history when we realize we've been on the wrong track. And the thing to do is not just keep going down the wrong track. It's to say, hey, we can make a change and for the better.
Tell me if I'm wrong on this, because you do this work, you're in this space much more than I am, but it seems like there's a lot of incentives to kind of keep things the status quo. I think about the for-profit prison industry. I think about the funding that probably a lot of police precincts are going to get to fight the war on drugs, et cetera. And also, I mean, I think a big part of this conversation that has gotten traction, but I think needs to be talked about more is the legal drug industry, right? I mean, when we have an opioid epidemic, and we're looking at some of these companies that are coming under fire legally and having massive fines for incentivizing doctors to overprescribe essentially legal heroin, in drugs that are incredibly potent and addictive to a degree that really do a lot of damage. It just seems like there are a lot of incentives to keep things the status quo and not a lot of incentives to change the status quo, at least in when it comes to money and power and politics. I mean, a lot of politicians run on being tough on crime and trying to fight the war on drugs, and people who might be more empathetic, right, and might have an approach of, actually, maybe we're looking at victims instead of criminals, so to speak, right? They tend to kind of get lambasted by other people as being soft and being, soft on crime. So you give me your perspective here. I mean, am I kind of reading the room, or am I kind of off on this? Is this perspective of changing how we view, drugs and people who use drugs and who maybe get addicted to them? is the perspective starting to shift, or do we still have a long road ahead of us?
All of that's true. There are massive financial incentives for lots of different people to keep doing what we have been doing, even though it is not working by its own measures of success. If you look at what the goal is, reduce drug use, reduce addiction, reduce overdose, reduce crime. The way we've handled drugs has increased all of those. It's like a
great,
it's a crime production approach because prohibition always incentivizes criminal activity. Mm. It's an overdose incentivizing approach because there's so much contamination on the underground market. So we have all of these negative outcomes. And there's a lot of people who are making a lot of money off of that approach, lots of different people. I think so. So that is one incentive. I think just as strong of an incentive is that we do not like to admit that we have been wrong.
Totally.
And we have.
It's not the American way.
It is not. It's not. And a lot of us have some sort of other incentive to keep going. So I'll give you an example. Like, I got a phone call from a mom one day whose daughter had struggled with heroin addiction. They have been through hell and back trying to help their daughter. They've eventually like cut off all communication with her. Just tragic, tragic situation. So she read an article that I had written in our newspaper in Mississippi. It was offering different solutions. And so on this phone call, she's struggling with me through this. Like the one part of her is certain that there was nothing else they could do. The other part says, well, our daughter did go to jail. That definitely didn't help her. And so I can kind of see where you're coming from that. But there are so many family members who have approached their loved one in a particular way. And for most of them, that has been with the ideological framework that we've grown up with, which is you're engaging in bad behavior. And what you need is some punishment, maybe a little shame, certainly some blame to get your act together. So for somebody to listen to and begin to rethink what might actually be going on in their loved one's life can be incredibly painful because they engaged in that behavior with their loved one out of the belief that they were doing the right thing, the thing that was going to help them make a change in their life. And yet I have a friend who lost his son to an overdose a couple of years ago, his only child.
Wow.
And he says, you know, when my son was struggling, he would have these, you know, a couple of months here and there of recovery, and then he would relapse. And instead of celebrating with him that like, look what you did. You made it for several months. That was so fantastic. And we're here to cheer you on. Let's try to get back on that wagon again. Mm-hmm. Instead, he focused all of his time and communication on the relapse. Why? Why did you do that again? Why didn't you continue down that path of recovery? So even if we take it just down to the very core relational level, it's very hard for people to even consider whether something they did that they thought was done in love might actually have been harmful to their family member. Or you think about a police officer who has spent his career enforcing our drug laws because that's what he was given to do when he joined the force. How maybe he's lost friends who were killed in raids in the line of duty. Maybe they stopped someone to search a car for drugs, that altercation went badly. And how hard is that for him to consider this might not have needed to happen? Like this could be a result. All of this could have been a result of failed policy, not actually something that was serving public safety. Those are really, really hard things. You take all of the financial thing out of it completely. We still have, almost all of us have been engaged in some way. Even for me, I didn't have either one of those. It still felt really hard to rethink something because it challenged me to come to terms with even the thoughts and feelings I had had over the course of my life about people who were using drugs or struggling with addiction. So I think there's lots of incentive, there's financial incentive, there's ideological incentive, there's behavioral incentive of the things we've engaged in that we don't want to have to rethink. Lots that is on that side of not wanting to rethink. But that's true of every, generation throughout history. It's always been hard to change. It has always been hard to rethink something. And we look back and we celebrate the courage of people who are willing to, over the course of history, and move societies forward towards peace, towards human rights, towards justice, because they were willing to stand up and say, there is change here that we can embrace, even if it's painful.
My name is Joseph Yu, and I am an Episcopalian priest, and I fully believe in what Project Amplify is trying to do, which is to amplify voices and theology, to offer a counter-narrative to the voices and platforms that uses the Bible as a leverage to marginalize, to exclude, and to dehumanize. Project Amplify wants to amplify voices and theology to talk about the love and justice of God and just how diverse and how inclusive our God is and the gospel is. So if you want to help provide a different narrative of what it means to be a Christian and a follower of Christ, please click the link below to donate. Thank you.
Let's talk about some of the maybe potential solutions that you see, because, you know, to your point a couple minutes ago when you were talking about how these things really are interconnected and they don't exist in a silo, right? I mean, maybe someone's motivation for selling, you know, drugs is because of poverty or not having access to a livable wage for their family. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons people end up doing things, you know, that are quote unquote illegal and they're not always just like this stereotypical Hollywood dramatized version of a bad person, right? Like, I just like to do bad things, so I'm going to sell drugs on the street corner. Like, there's more than meets the eye usually going on there. And I also, you know, think about, is the solution to like decriminalize drugs? I mean, I think about Portland, Oregon and their experiment with that. And it didn't really go that well, frankly, and I'm someone who tends to be very progressive in a lot of ways, but, you know, it looks like, from what I understand, and someone's probably going to email me correcting me on this, but my understanding is that they essentially decriminalized drugs, but they didn't really have the funding and social infrastructure for mental health and just like well-being resources. So you had like this gap that wasn't able to be filled, and it just caused a lot of damage to a lot of people. So, you know, for you, when you look at like the current landscape in America, it seems like if we don't have a robust healthcare system where healthcare is accessible and affordable to everyone, and we have a hard time getting jobs that offer a livable wage, right? Where people can actually keep their head above water and they can afford a house. Without those things, I feel like just decriminalizing or having a more empathetic posture towards people who struggle with substance abuse isn't actually going to like really solve the problem, mm-hmm. because there are other needs that need to be filled in their life, to going back to your Rat Pack, you know, experiment, so to speak. What are your thoughts on that? Like, how do you think about ways forward for us as a country when it comes to drugs, whether they're legal or not, regulated or not, and how we help people who, you know, did not expect in their life to get hooked on certain substances that are literally killing them?
Yeah. So I think of it in a couple different ways. I think of it as when we look at the different sort of categories of harm. So if you look at kind of categories of harm to consumers, well, we don't want them dying from contamination. That's 100,000 people a year dying from drug overdose. The majority of them from contaminated drugs that they bought on the street.
When you say contaminated, you mean like fentanyl, like something else is inside the drug that isn't advertised.
Correct. Okay, yes, you buy like a little bag of something and you hope for the best.
Right.
That sort of thing.
Okay.
And so the only way that you can really meaningfully address that problem is by allowing consumers to access legally regulated substances where they at least know what they're getting. They can dose it appropriately. Fentanyl has been used in hospitals for decades in this country. Every day. It's used every day right now. It's not a problem at all because it can be dosed appropriately for the weight of the person who's taking it. You know, that doctors and nurses know how to use fentanyl. When you get a little baggie of something on the street, you don't have any idea. Is it enough that's going to get you high? Is it going to kill you? Is there no fentanyl in there at all? It is just a Russian roulette sort of experience on the street. So that can really only be addressed meaningfully through some sort of legal access for adults to a legally regulated substance.
Yeah.
That's true on the the crime side also of how people get drawn into drug dealing in the underground market. There's so much money to be made because you have $500 billion a year of consumer cash. So those are consumers that are holding out their money to anyone who's going to produce these drugs and sell them to them.
Look, I watch enough of these like docu-crime shows on Discovery Plus.
There's a thousand of them on
this. And when I see some person with a blurred out face saying, I make 10 grand a day, you know, selling weed, I'm like, you know, like I can't say I don't understand the allure, you know, because when you're making like, you know, serious cash, I'm not saying it's ethical. I'm just saying I get it.
You know?
Like 10 grand a day would be
humans,
great. You know?
Humans are not good at leaving massive piles of cash untouched. Somebody is going to take that. And even if you arrest every drug dealer in a city right now, they'll all be replaced in an hour.
Totally.
Because there's still consumers there. They're still holding out their cash and they want to buy some drugs from whoever's going to sell it to them. So you can't arrest your way out of drug dealing. It is, as long as we keep pushing these popular drugs into an underground market, it's incentivizing crime and violence. Hmm. That is felt primarily in inner cities. The people who have the least resources to live in whatever the gated community or wherever they're going to be safest, they're the ones that are paying the price for these underground drug markets the most. When you look south of our border, same thing is happening. You have whole countries that are rocked by violence and by corruption from cartels that have massive amounts of cash, which allows them to buy guns and tanks and pay off politicians and all sorts of things that destabilize their countries.
I watch those shows too.
Yes, there's so many of them. Yeah. And the shocking thing is, so much of that is preventable. It is, we can't even imagine a world where cartels don't have the kind of power that they do, but the vast majority of their funding comes from drug prohibition. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned earlier about kind of big pharma. So there's some hard realities we've got to deal with on this front. It's part of what I talk about in the book too, of There's no world where no one makes money from drugs.
Right.
We can try to regulate appropriately. You can at least hold big pharma accountable. How are you going to hold, the cartel in South America? Well, sure, you can arrest their kingpin. That's all that's going to happen there is violence is going to increase while all the lieutenants kill each other off trying to figure out who's going to become the new kingpin. And there's this destabilization from this leadership vacuum. So you have overdose, you have crime that's caused by these underground drug markets. You can address that by bringing these drugs back into legal, regulated markets. This is not candy aisle. This is, no 7-Eleven. This is, we have regulatory structures. We can develop new ones for potentially harmful drugs. You're probably going to regulate marijuana differently than you would regulate cocaine.
Right.
But no drug is made safer by pushing it into this complete free-for-all of the underground market. I mean, kids you can order anything you want on Snapchat anytime you want. I mean, the internet has made drug accessibility incredible for kids of any age that have a phone in their hand. And so for us parents who are thinking, well, it just won't happen to us, drugs are more available and cheaper now than they've ever been. That's the reality of the world that we're living in. And they're contaminated, which means the risk for our kids getting their hands on whatever they're going to get their hands on is really high. So I see it as a great move to decriminalize possession, like Oregon did. So my perspective on Oregon, I was watching some of the research that came out of that. And so Oregon had an interesting situation because they decriminalized drug possession, but they did not have any laws against public drug use. Hmm. So that didn't have to be that way. They could have said, we're going to not arrest for possession, but we aren't going to allow you to use in front of McDonald's or whatever the case may be. They did not do that. And so you had this situation where there is lots of public drug use. And that's what people are seeing on the news. That's what people who live in Oregon are upset about. And there was no law against that. So part of it was there were other ways to solve the problems that were coming out of that. And the funding for that whole mental health addiction treatment piece only started rolling out in 2022. So the law passed in 2020. Funding didn't begin until 2022. And there was only a 4-month data window where we actually had data before they rolled it back. So there, wow. And that's 4 months of like, you don't even have time to see any trajectory.
Right.
It's just nothing. 4 months of data from the time this begins. And even when you think about money starts rolling out in 2022, well, you can't build a whole system of care in 3 months. I mean, that's going to take years for all of those treatment opportunities to be built out for them, for people to build trust to know, hey, you can go to this place. They're going to treat you well. You're going to be able to get the help that you need. So it's really sad to me that they moved that they rolled that back so quickly and didn't take a more nuanced approach to say, what's the real problem here? Is it that people are possessing drugs, or is it that people are engaging in rampant public drug use that's making our public places, you know, not family friendly, not places the rest of the community can enjoy? And the other part that was very unfortunate about timing was that, so fentanyl came to the East Coast first and began moving its way across the country. Fentanyl really hit Oregon hard in 2020, the exact same year that decriminalization was voted on and passed. And so you had this incredible uptick in overdose that happened to coincide with decriminalization. But the research on that shows it was not related to it. It was just, it happened in the same way that happened to surrounding states at the same time. But it got blamed for it. You know, the decriminalization got blamed for the uptick in overdose deaths. And so they have had things that happened simultaneously that were unfortunate. And now we don't get to know what could have happened if they had had more than 4 months of actual data collection when the program was running before it began to get rolled back. And now has been, drug possession has been recriminalized there as of this week. Their governor just signed that bill. So I think, to me, that's not I don't look at that and say it didn't work. I say that it was an unfortunate situation where a lot of things happened simultaneously and we didn't get to see how well it worked.
Yeah.
But when you think about, like, now people will just be arrested for drug possession again, that's not going to fix the problem.
Right.
You're still going to, you might not see some of those people for a period of time until they get back out again. But jail isn't going to make their lives better. It's probably going to make their lives a lot harder. And so we have an opportunity to stick with this change long enough to say we are going to commit to not doing the wrong thing, and we're going to start doing more of the right thing. And to me, even as somebody who is a small government person, I could heartily agree on, let's at least shift resources from enforcement to making sure that people can get accessible mental health care. If taxpayers are already paying for the incarceration of someone, let's at least instead use that money towards something that will actually help them and increase public safety, increase community well-being, increase the health of that person's life.
1,000%. I am all about having my tax dollars go to building robust resources for people to get help that they need, like without them paying $35,000 for like an 8-day treatment, you know, because I know the cost that some of these places charge, and it's a lot of money. And sometimes, you know, insurance doesn't always cover it and all that stuff. And you're right. I mean, listen, we spend the most on our military out of anywhere in the world. We obviously have money, a lot of it, and we will spend it on things that we think are important. And I think that it frustrates a lot of people that when it comes to the quote unquote war on drugs, we've been in this cycle of chaos now for decades, and it's obviously not working. But, you know, again, when you have a for-profit prison system, when you have people making a lot of money and a lot of them have strong lobbyists and strong ties to government, you know, lawmakers, et cetera, it can be very frustrating to see that people who, you know, struggle with substance addiction are almost in a sense re-victimized by a system that wants to keep them there, you know, or keep them in prison so they can get paid X amount per prison or whatever it is, instead of actually looking at, to your point, what's really causing this? What are some real ways of offering treatment? Are there any countries in the world that you look at and go, now they're handling, you know, drugs really well with some real world results that are actually lowering, you know, drug use and all that stuff? Is there anywhere on the planet that you think is doing a good job of this?
So one of the countries that does the most innovative and are having some of the best outcomes is Switzerland. So they started doing, like, decades ago, they started doing what's called heroin-assisted treatment. So doctors can prescribe heroin to somebody who has a heroin addiction, which sounds crazy, but it's very counterintuitive.
to my American ass, it definitely sounds counterintuitive, but I'm curious. Keep going.
It does. And so, but what they found is that, so in the beginning, it was not in any kind of like take home. You couldn't like take it with you. It was, you could come to a clinic and use. So you could come 3 times a day if you wanted to, and you could use heroin. You could use as much as you wanted, as long as it didn't actually, like you couldn't take enough to overdose and die. But they let people self-regulate how much they were going to take. Now it's in a clinic. So they're also getting opportunities for other kinds of care that they might need. They're getting asked questions about, you know, how is your life and what are the kinds of dreams and hopes and goals that you have and how could we help support you in those things? And what they found is that number one, it increased public safety because it took people out of that rat race of how am I going to get enough drugs to feed my addiction, which is where a lot of property crime comes from. It's people who are addicted, who are stealing things and selling them or engaging in prostitution. A lot of that is related to getting enough money to feed an addiction. So when people could come to the clinic and they were out of that rat race, they had all this time on their hands. So they had time now to begin thinking about what is it that I want to fill my life up with because I'm not spending my days just trying to get enough drugs. And what they found is that people over time, almost all of them decreased their drug use on their own. And many of them stopped completely, not because they were forced to. There was no end point on this program, but because as people were able to fill their life up with meaning, they were able to empty it of the other thing that was filling up the emptiness in their life. You kind of think of it like a cup. If somebody has an addiction where the drugs are filling up the majority of that cup in terms of their what they spend their time thinking about, what they spend their time going after, you can't just empty that cup. Humans can't live with nothing. Mm. We need meaning and purpose in our life. So as we can help people fill their cup up with, think of it as like rocks, you know, that water, that drug use is not needed in there anymore. There's less and less and less of it because our cup is already full with good things. And so they've done great work around expanding access to different kinds of medication-assisted treatment, whether that's heroin-assisted treatment or whether it is just making access to something like methadone, which is legal here in the U.S., but it's very difficult to get. You have to be in person at a clinic every single day to get it. And yet it is a proven effective treatment for addiction, and it's very difficult to access. There's a mom who lost her son to an overdose, and she said, it's crazy that it's easier to get heroin than it is to get the medication that can keep you from using heroin, that can help you stop using heroin. Mm. And so we've made access to legal treatment much harder to access than it is to just go get some drug on the street. So we could significantly expand access to drug treatment medications that can improve life. They save lives. They help people stabilize their life and build a life that they want to be fully present for. So there's no country that has moved back to, there are countries that have legalized cannabis, but there are no countries that have moved back, kind of rolled back the whole 100 years that we have been doing this experiment in prohibition. Mm. A lot of that has to do with it. The U.S. has kind of holds the keys on a lot of this. And so we're the ones that began the global movement towards criminalization and prohibition about 100 years ago. And I think that puts us, we need to be on the front lines of saying, hey, we're ready to rethink this and move in a different direction because we're losing so many lives. We're losing so many people. We're giving up so much public safety. We're destabilizing so many families in our own country as well as across the world. We bear some responsibility to say, let's make a different change and let's pursue solutions. It's going to be painful. No matter what we do, it's going to be painful. There is no perfect solution to a broken world with drugs in it, but there are much better solutions than the ones that we have been using.
No, I'm with you all the way on that. So yeah, I mean, I think you're right on the money, and I hope that we can get to a point in my lifetime and in yours where we see serious drug reform that actually puts the people who are struggling with substance addiction first, instead of putting for-profit industries first at their expense. The book is Curious, A Foster's Mom, Discovery of an Unexpected Solution to Drugs and Addiction by Christina Dent. Christina, it's been great to have you on the podcast. If folks want to follow more of your work or check out the work that you do online, where should they go?
Yeah, you can go check out the book and get it on Amazon. Head over to enditforgood.com. You can sign up for our newsletter. I write those. It's commentary on things like what's happening in Oregon. It's resources. We just launched merchandise. You can just come and see all the things that we're up to. We've also got some great freebies, how to have productive conversations on polarizing issues. You can check that out at enditforgood.com/freebies. We also have, if you have a family member who's struggling with an addiction, we have another freebie that's just three ways to help someone struggling with an addiction. Talks about things that most people haven't heard about, like community reinforcement and family training, which is a way that families can help their loved one make a change for the better. It's evidence-based. So lots of great resources, enditforgood.com. You can follow us on social media. We would love to connect with you. And if you get the book, you can email me. Let me know what you think about it. If you've heard this interview, shoot us an email, curious@enditforgood.com. Let us know what you think. Send us all your tough questions. We're here for it. We want to engage and help people have good conversations and consider shifting the way we approach drugs and addiction to a health-centered one. We think it really could revolutionize the world and help a lot of people.
Awesome. Love that. Well, thank you so much for your time. Keep in touch. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Thanks, Tim.